on in a few more minutes. Okay, what I thought we'd do today is today, and if we have class next week, which I'm planning to, there's a little, we may not, but the week after that I'll be gone, right back east, unless I decide not to go, which is also a possibility. But in any case, the text that we're going to take, probably the Mandukya Upanishad, I haven't made a final decision, but I'm thinking that would be a good text to take. I haven't taught it for a long time, and it's also a very visionary text, all Advaita, you know, beautiful text. And the Upanishad actually totally unpacks and unfolds the meaning of the word Om. The Om is really the name for Brahman, the name for Ishwara, actually. And so in that way, it would be a really beautiful text. And then the Karika, written by Gaudapada, really unfolds in verse form everything that's said in the Upanishad in tremendous depth. And it's a beautiful Upanishad. We could at least take the Upanishad in the first chapter of the Karika and then see if we want to do the third and fourth chapter, second, third, and fourth chapter also. We can see that that's a very big undertaking for once a week. But we could definitely do the first chapter and then see how we're doing, all doing. So I would like to do that, but I want to let students know, and I want most of the people to come back from the ashram. And I also don't like to just start a text and then leave. It's also kind of inauspicious to do that. Maybe like to do more than two verses, or at least 2 weeks, but preferably 3 weeks, and then you're off and running and you haven't broken it. So, in the meantime, I thought what we could do is, some of you really haven't been through the whole process of meditation, so I'd like to talk in depth about meditation and break it up with some exercises so that you can really understand kind of why we do some of these things, especially all of the precursors to meditation that we do when we first start sitting. There's some important things to do or things to understand in order for the mind to become, to resolve the mind. If certain things aren't taken care of, then those things are knocking at the door while you're trying to meditate. So I want to take you through all of these things, and I can do it, you know, if we spend 2 weeks on it. Then you'll have kind of an in-depth overview of it. I think it makes a big difference. It's helpful. So I thought what we could do, we'll just have a short meditation, maybe 10 or 15 minutes at the most. And then I'll talk about meditation and break that up with just short exercises so you can actually experience what I'm talking about. That's what I'm thinking. And then depending on how the time goes, we may at the end have a like another 15 minute or so meditation, so we can just sit with that. That's what I think we should try that. Does that sound okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Hi Marjorie. Hi Chris. Hi Dayton. Hi Anne. Welcome. Okay, so I'll just take a moment. Yeah. Okay. Yourself is always full and complete and free. Meditation is not a problem for the Atma, for the self. Your mind, when it is shanti, when it's not agitated, that mind is easily available, that buddhi, you know, the intellect, is very much available to just recognize the presence of your being, the presence that totally fills the mind. It can easily, like a clean mirror, just turn around as though and notice your own presence, because the mind itself isn't distracted. And so that naturally quiet, abiding mind that's free from distraction, free from raga dvesha. Raga dvesha means all these likes and dislikes and preferences that are irritating us, you know. When the mind is free of those things, then it's in a condition where it can relax, it can recognize the world as Ishvara, you know, because at that moment it itself doesn't really want anything to be different, it's just abiding. And so in that abiding mind, I can bring my knowledge, my understanding into that abiding mind, when it is abiding. Right, so when the mind is abiding, I can say, that has that shanti, I can bring in a mahavakya, or a statement that I've understood at the time of teaching, like, I am Ishvara. Because I know what that means, I've recognized the truth of it at the time of teaching, I understand. But now when the mind is quiet and peaceful, if I bring a statement like that in, which I've already understood at the time of teaching, then my mind can become absorbed in the truth of that understanding. It's as though nididhyasana is like shravana, or the unfolding that takes place at the time of teaching, but in slow motion, where you bring your mind into that absorbed state and then insert a mahavakya like I am Ishvara, or anandoham, I am ananda, I am fullness, because I know what fullness means. I'm not looking for an understanding of fullness, I'm just using a statement to direct my mind to the truth of what that statement is. Like, say, if I understand the nature, and I've seen at the time of teaching what we mean by the word ananda in relationship to the self, then if I say I am ananda, then that word points to and resolves into the meaning of the word. Like, even now, if I say the word lamp, a vritti in the form of a lamp will come. Or if I say apple, then the word apple brings an apple. But so Amaji will joke and say, but if I say gugubugai, he says, if I say gugubugai, your mind is just stuck with gugubugai. Nothing comes because you have no idea what that means. But really, when you say ananda, I am ananda, you have to know what the word means for you not to just be stuck. You know, what if you translate ananda as bliss and you say, I am bliss? Then your mind says, I am bliss. Well, that means I have to conjure up a bliss experience. So there's no knowledge about what the word really means. And then you really can't use the word because it's not evoking the knowledge. It's not evoking its meaning. Like simple words like chair or plant, or they evoke their meaning. You see what I mean? So when we use in nididhyasana, what we want to do is use words in a way to help the mind stay with the meaning that you've already understood at the time of teaching. But now, to do that, or to even begin to have that type of meditation be meaningful, the mind has to enjoy a certain amount of relaxation and shanti, you know, and peacefulness, so that we can actually do that with the mind. And so what that means then is that there's a lot of precursors to bring the mind into that type of stable, a restful condition. Now, all of these precursors that we're going to go through, I feel like these things that we do in meditation to bring the mind into that state of relaxation are actually become just a way of life. It becomes just a way of being with your mind and being with your body, and even a way of holding your relationship with others. And so I'm just going to go through kind of step by step these things that if we spend time with them, the mind gains shanti in relationship to all of the things that are causing one level or another of irritation. And there are many levels in the mind too, not just one. There's many different type relational levels. And we have to know how to be with all of those different relational levels so that they can feel, so you can feel some shanti in each one of the levels. Okay? So, just a couple more things before I go level by level. Not every part of you has knowledge. Like if there's little child parts in the unconscious, for instance, they don't have knowledge. I say you have a little child. You can't say, don't worry, you're Brahman. You know? They don't care about Brahman. It doesn't make any difference. They're not developmentally at that age. Okay? So your knowledge does not work with that child relationally. It works. It will work for you. Your knowledge will be helpful in how you can hold the little child, you know, and the patience, your level of patience, your level of compassion, your level of care. Your knowledge really helps with that. But you can't teach the little child Vedanta because it's not ready for that. You know, it's not a mumukshu. Right? So those are, so when we're talking about how to deal with some of our unconscious things, you have to remember that. You know, that the little ones inside, frozen in time inside, they're not jnanis, and they're not going to be jnanis. They're little children, and they need to be dealt with in a certain way so that actually those developmentally arrested parts in the unconscious have a chance to be released into the conscious mind. So that energy that's being held in the unconscious in the form of little split-off parts, this is very Jungian, but it is very, it has a lot of truth in it, in that you can really experience the results of having some type of inner relationship with all the little parts inside. But as we come into relationship with them, the goal is not to give them self-knowledge. The goal is to release them developmentally so the energy that's held in all of those parts of the unconscious can be released into the conscious mind and blend back in with the conscious mind rather than being split off and held in the unconscious. But the only point we're going to do a lot with that, but the only point I'm making right there is that in these little unconscious parts of you that we'll be working with, it's not about, or even teenage parts, or little infants, or little, you know, 5 or 6 year old parts, it's not about giving them knowledge, it's about being a good parent and giving them, releasing them from the pain of what they didn't get, so that those parts of your psyche can be set free. So that's an image, a way of imaging it, but it's helpful. It works. Now that being something we have to work through that, there's also your relationships outside. With your parents, with your siblings, with your partner, especially, I mean, some people have partners who are on the same spiritual path as they are, but many people don't. So there's your partners, your colleagues, your friends in general, your family, your parents, on and on and on and on. These people are probably not mumukshus. They're not jnanis. They're not mumukshus. And they don't really want to know about your spiritual path. You know, and they don't want the platitudes. That's what it sounds like. You know, they don't really care about that. They don't want that. They just want to be cared for. They want to be with somebody who respects them and cares about them and gives them the benefit of the doubt, etc., just like we all do. So it's not about knowledge. The knowledge part in these type of relationships has to do with you having enough of a kind of an inner sanctuary inside that can allow you to give you the freedom to accommodate the world and to accommodate others. So that's the blessing of the knowledge. It's definitely not going to be useful to have any type of table, what I call table talk, or Swamiji referred to it that way too, table talk Vedanta. You know, so that'll solve a problem, which doesn't solve a problem. Vedanta, which is, can be so precious and so useful for you, is also precious and useful for another mumukshu. And not only that, it's another mumukshu who, for whatever reason, wants to learn from you. And that's also another little caveat there. They can be a mumukshu, but you may not be their teacher. Yeah. So if they're a mumukshu and you're not their teacher, then there's really no guru-sisha relationship there for Vedanta to transpire. So for Vedanta to transpire, for that vision to take place, there has to be kind of an open channel, you know. By, I don't mean that in any occult or any. All I mean by that is there's something in the heart of the teacher and the heart of the student that is open. It's because a knowledge takes place on a very deep level, and you, there's something inside of you that is willing to really be present to that knowledge as it's coming through the mouth of that teacher. There's two things. That particular teacher, you know, and the knowledge itself. The heart has to be open to both. Could be open to Vedanta, but not to that person. You know, that's just how it is. And so, anyway. These things, they're just simple things. It's not things that we don't know. But what I'm saying is, when we're going now, going in this meditative process, we're going to go into some relationship. That park is really well used. By many, many different people. There's a lot more homeless people now too, and a lot of them are parking because they don't have any home. I mean, regular people who used to have a home, who used to have a job, you know, they're not now. Now they're living in their cars, and so there's kind of there's pressure now, and a lot of this type of stuff also. Okay, so why I'm telling all of this is because what is causing strife that takes away your shanti, you know, it has to do, you know, usually not with being in class and listening to this vision. It has to do with our, because that takes away the strife, right? It has to do with the day-to-day relationships. Day-to-day relationships, internal relationships. It has to do with relationship. Internal relationship, the relationship with my body, the relationship with my house, the relationship with my family, the relationship with my friends, relationship, 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 the relationship with my own mind. And so how am I? How are all of these relationships? You know, and where are these relationships going awry? And you can definitely know where they're going to ride because they're causing you pain, you know. And you can feel it also when you're sitting to meditate, just relaxing. Where is your mind spinning off? Where is it going? You know, and why is it going there? So there's a number of things that we can do when we meditate, and there are things that you can kind of learn to take care of throughout the day also, because it's not very hard. There's things that you can learn to take care of throughout the day just to give the mind some shanti and relaxation. It has to do with resolving these worries and these relational worries. Okay, so there's just kind of an easy process that we can go through, and I'm going to kind of take us through a couple of them now, and I'll kind of explain it along the way. Another couple of things is, some of these things, like inner child work that we'll be doing, or even working with relaxing your body, some of these things can actually take the whole meditation, and they could take the whole meditation for weeks on end. You know, to where you don't even get past that particular thing, because there's so much, you know, there's so much that the little ones inside want to say. Or if we're going through, like, your family and there's tension with this particular person, you might spend a lot of time in that particular area until you come to some sort of shanti around it. After some time, these things don't take very long. But it's only don't take very long because you've been with it long enough that the unconscious problems are resolving and feel held. But until that's the case, they can take some time. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. In fact, with some of this inner child work, dealing with the little ones inside, people have actually done that for months. And the thing is, they've gone ahead and done it for months, or however long, it could be days, it doesn't, there's no time, there's no particular amount of time. They do it for however long that feels like what the mind wants to be doing. You know, because say the mind is getting, you're getting into inner relationships that are meaningful, and they hold some energy, and then you think, well, you know, I've done this for 15 minutes, I don't think I should do it any longer, because actually I'm supposed to be meditating, you know? But actually, this part is very, very valuable. And later, you can spend the majority of the time doing, you know, Ishwaroham or something. But some of this inner stuff, this inner work, becoming familiar with it, for it to become really easy for you, is well worth the time. Because what you find is, as you do some of this work, the natural level of shanti that the mind enjoys increases, because you've taken care of some of this underlying tension. Right? One thing Jung has said that I find really, really valuable, one of his main teachings was what we call the reality of the psyche. And that means that in a relationship he has, like say with a little child or even with a wisdom figure, we'll be doing some of those too. He just takes them as real on that level as this level is real. Like for instance, if I have a relationship with a child or an adult or a wise person on this level, then I don't pretend that it's not real. I don't even say, oh, this is all mitya. That's not, absolutely not the point. What if I'm talking to you and I say, well, you're mitya? You know? So ideal, there's a certain order in our relationships and there's a certain etiquette, and I take you to be as, you know, real and as a substantial person as I am. You know, if I can go like this to me and go like that to you, the same order of reality. He looks at it also that the inner world of relationships are also very real, and they have to be treated with a certain amount of respect. And that what he'll mean by that is, say we're doing some inner work, you're doing work, some little child has come up, some part of you has come up and wants some attention, and you're talking, and then you say something to it like, we have to stop now, but I won't forget about you, and I will be back tomorrow. And then tomorrow comes, and you forgot about him or her, and you don't come back. That part of you will not forget what you said. Honestly, it won't forget, and then you didn't come back, and so you didn't keep your word. And so the hurt of that part will then be increased, not helped. No. And so that, you don't have to, or I would say don't believe or disbelieve that, just add some shraddha. Shraddha means that, let me see if that's true and let me be respectful so that I can appreciate that as I learn about it, you know, that particular reality. So, what we're doing at these early stages and these precursors to actually meditating is bringing our relational world into some, and giving it some attention. And even though we're giving even the external world internal attention, right, that brings shanti. Like say if I have a bad relationship with somebody and I work on that internally, that changes how I'm holding it and gives me some peace. So I want to try and work on a few things like that. There's too much to do in one. There's too many different exercises to do in one sitting. And we don't do all of the same things at the same time. That once you learn all of these things, they just become tools that are natural to you, and you use them when they're when you need them. You know? And what you may spend a long time on at some given point may just be a simple hello and another, or not even a word. It's just the relationship is there and it's fine. So, even though I'll be coughing, it's too bad. But I can try to do it anyway. My cough will be part of the part of the thing that needs some love. Okay, so first thing first, is to just let yourself get into a really comfortable position where you can truly relax. You know, you can practice having a lotus position when you're practicing yoga and all of that, but when you really are meditating, try to get into a position that you can hold for a while, where you can be comfortable. And that's the first thing. Just move your body around until you can enjoy it. The position you're in. That's one important. And the other is to avoid giving yourself any type of time limit. Like to say, by time limit I mean to say, all right, we're going to meditate for 1/2 hour, we're going to meditate for 1 hour, we're going to meditate for 15 minutes. I would say don't try to avoid that, because the mind, especially when you're first sitting and relaxing, 15 minutes might look like a really long time. And the mind will get kind of stressed by that type of restriction. So, your mind and body should know that it's when you're ready to stop the meditation, that's fine. You can stop. So that the mind doesn't have to worry about that. You know. Just take a few deep breaths just to help the body relax. Now, another thing that can be worrisome to your mind is all the things that you really do have to do today or tonight, and things that you don't want to forget, and maybe worried that it'll take too long doing this. It could be anything. And so I want you just now for a moment, just to only give you a minute or so to do this, just ask your mind, is there anything that you're worried about or you want to let me know? Anything I have to do, I want. Because the idea is you want your mind to know that you are aware of these things and you will take care of it. So just ask your mind, just very simply, is there anything, you know, that's concerning you or that you want me to remember? Say, I won't forget this, I will remember. I know these things do have to be done. And then the mind will be able to give up some of its responsibility. Can relax. Just let yourself be aware of your body and come into relationship, but have a relationship with your body, a friendship, an appreciation, and just give your body some friendship. Be more than just a feeling. Actually, speak to your body quietly to yourself. Like say something simple like, thank you for keeping good health. Thank you for doing all that you do for me. Just some simple words. Appreciate it. With just simple words. And now notice also all of your sense organs, your eyes and your ears. Sense of taste, your sense of smell, sense of touch. All of these are functioning. And just give some, come into relationship with these parts. Just notice them, thank them. Feel each one, like feel your eyes. You can be aware of your eyes and just think of all they do for you. How important they are, what it would mean not to have them. And your ears, that you can hear sound, that we can communicate what it means to have your ears. Sense of smell. A sense of taste. And feel your sense of touch running through the entire body. Just run your consciousness, run your mind from the top of your head all the way down through the body. Every part of it, and just let yourself relax. And Take some deep breaths just to feel what it's like to bring breath into your body. Do some work on the mind itself a little bit later, but for now I want your mind to address your unconscious and just say, using words again, not just feelings but actually using words, just address all of the little ones, the parts inside, assuming that they're all there. And just simply say, does anyone inside have anything to say? And see, does anyone inside have anything they want to share, anything they want to tell me? We're just going to spend a little bit of time now doing that. And there may be maybe more than one, there may be many. And say, I'll get to everybody eventually, but I'll talk with you first and then just see what that part has to say. Be a good friend, a good listener. Ask for more details if you want to. Just spend some time in conversation with those parts inside. See if they can tell you how they really feel. You don't have to have a solution. Later you may be able to give some advice, but first find out what they really feel. relationship you may be having, and if you can say say this truthfully, that you will be back to continue those relationships. Please give that assurance, and then just take a moment and then come back into the room. You can see how this little section can be 5 minutes, or it could be a long time, depending on how much time you want to give it. But what you're actually doing is your buddhi. You know, your buddhi is the one that gains knowledge, right? And your buddhi really is the one who, your buddhi is the one who's brings your knowledge and your values, and your knowledge and your values, your buddhi is what brings that to others. And so, for instance, it's your buddhi. Now, your buddhi, when it's objectifying the body, for instance, your buddhi is coming into with its values, you know, is coming into relationship with the body. And so, that say the buddhi. Now, it's not being overwhelmed at this time by the manas or by the emotions or by your raga dvesha. It's just the buddhi is taking on the stance of being an inner friend, really, a friend. And it's coming into relationship with your body as a friend, you know, and giving it love and giving it respect. Because all of us, at many times in our day, know very well how to be a friend. You're very capable of being a good friend, or being caring. And that's the part, that's what you're evoking. It's those values that you're evoking in the buddhi. And then the buddhi, with that type of inner friendship and care, is now directing, it's coming into relationship with the body, which can be tense and uptight and feel unloved and unappreciated. But you're coming into relationship with it and giving, you know, an attitude and a way of being that can make the body relax. You can think of it just like they've wired up plants with electrodes. If you come toward a plant with care and love and appreciate it, you know, the plant has a lot of shanti. If you come at it with any type of anger, it has fear. And your body's the same way. So we're giving them, everything's that way. So bringing the buddhi toward the body, toward the in relationship, as a good friend toward your body, and letting it relax in that. So at this time, we're not angry at the body, we're not critical of the body, and we appreciate it and we want it to relax. So we're giving it some time out, some special attention, just at this meditative point of meditation. It's the same with your sense organs. We don't usually give them any attention. But now the buddhi is coming into relationship with your sense organs, and it gives them an environment in which they can excel, in which they can flourish, in which they can relax. So we work with the body in this way. It's a very, very simple principle. And then we do it to the mind itself, giving just the manas, the mind. The buddhi comes into relationship with the thoughts and moods and emotions, and just asks the conscious mind, you know, what is there anything that you need? Is there anything that's concerning you? We're just on a totally conscious level, but the buddhi now is coming into relationship with that type of the part of the mind that's carrying worries and concerns and thinks you're going to forget this or that, and you know, the to-do list that it has to carry in the mind is stressful. And now you're meditating. I mean, maybe you're going to forget. All these things. So you're bringing in that that attitude of friendship to the mind. So it's all simple, 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 but the body and the mind and the sense organs appreciate it, and they relax, you know. Then when you're addressing the unconscious with words, does anybody inside have any? And words with the body, words toward the sense organs, you know. Swamiji taught me that in a very simple way. I think I've told in this class, in fact, where he said, you know, it's not, and he was talking about in the world, but I think it's true in my own experimenting in my own practice. I think it's true with your body and mind and sense organs also, the unconscious. Words aren't enough. He said, words aren't enough. You can have such warm feelings towards someone or such appreciation, but they really don't know that you feel that way unless you say. You can have so much gratitude, you know, and so much respect for a person, but you're the one carrying that, and they're not mind readers. And so they may feel the kind of relaxation of your presence when they're around, but they have no idea, you know, that you care about them. And he said, I had to remember that. I had to remind myself to actually say, because I would take it for granted that people knew that. And I think the body and the mind and the sense organs are the same way. If you actually say the words, you know, the body responds to it. The sense organs, the mind responds to the words that are carrying those feelings. And it's the same with the unconscious. Like, if you want to dialogue with the unconscious, it's not just a silent dialogue. You don't have to say out loud, but if you say, for instance, if you're just generic and you're saying something like, does anyone inside have anything to say? Then if there's any pressure inside, any of those parts inside that have something, they'll start talking. They'll say, you know. If you have a feeling inside, like say inside you just have a feeling, you can say, I feel your sadness, what is that? Where you're actually, you can say that you're personifying it, but actually you're just talking to the sadness. Now tell me what that is about. You know, or if there's anger, you're feeling angry. This is the buddhi now. The buddhi is aware of the emotion. You know, so that your buddhi says, you're feeling angry. Tell me about it. What is it really? What are you angry about? And you can't, and you have to say it as an inner friend. You can't say, you're feeling angry. You know, then the unconscious just, you know, it's had enough of that. Then it just runs back into its, you know, its room and shuts the door. But if you're trying to help, you know, and you say, you know, you're feeling hurt or you're feeling angry, tell me what it is. And, you know, very often your unconscious, that part, will tell you. You know, and then you can ask for more. Well, tell me more. And if you understand what that part is talking about, then you can say, I know. And you can even say, like, say that part is a child part inside, and you remember feeling that way when you were young. You can say, I remember. I remember when those things happened that made you feel that way, but you're feeling that way now. What is making you feel that way now? And a lot of times those inner feelings originate way, way in the past, but something in the present has triggered them. And so when those parts start talking to you, you can say, you know, this is how you used to feel when mom or dad did such whatever it is. You know, but this person may not be meaning that. You can do a little discernment, but only after you figure out what is really the problem. Sometimes you have some things you can say, you know, but even if you have things to say, that can be helpful. But you know what the main thing is that you're there, and you've come into relationship with these parts that usually we don't have any relationship with. If you do have relationship with those parts, it's because you've learned it. But people go through their whole life without learning this at all. You know? And when it's not learned, this coming into relationship with these, all of these parts and feelings inside, what happens is you have the feeling, you know, you have a feeling or you have an emotion, and that's just who you are. You're sad, you're angry, you're upset, and the cause for the sadness or the anger, the upset is whatever the situation is. So you're a sad, angry person because this happened. And that's what it is. Whereas if the buddhi is able to objectify and say, you're feeling angry, what is that really about? Then you'll find it's about a lot more. There's a lot of things that it's about. Yeah, and you're coming into relationship with it, which means that angry part or that hurt part now has a friend. Internally, there's a friend. There's somebody who cares. There's somebody who wants to help. Otherwise, what it can be is that something happens and you're angry. So now I'm an angry person, and who's going to help me? I have to look around for somebody to help me. What am I going to do? You know, who's going to help me? I'm all alone in this angry state, and somebody out here has to help me. Whereas this is totally different. You have an anger or hurt, and then there's a part of you, the buddhi, that knows how to come and be with you. Be with that angry part, and now it's relational. See what I mean? And so internally, you're not alone anymore. The buddhi comes into relationship with all of the emotions, and the buddhi holds the values and the well-being and the inner friendship. You know, it's like the guru, or it's like the guru or the therapist or the good friend or the good parent comes in to be with that part. And then you'll find why this is so helpful is that then what happens as we learn how to do that, it just becomes a matter of course, that underlying the hurt or the upset or the confusion or whatever it is, underlying that is the buddhi which has shanti. The buddhi which is the inner friend that cares, that wants to help. That's underlying the hurt. And so now that shanti is holding the hurt, but the bottom line is the shanti. See what I mean? And so when I do all of that, like just like with a little child or your friend or anybody in the world, if you come to a person's aid as a friend who cares and wants to help, that also very much helps the person who's in trouble, you know? Just like I can think in my own life of at times when maybe I've been upset or hurt and there was somebody there that came to help me. That is very comforting, you know, to have somebody who comes and helps you. You know, I'd say internally. It's very, very comforting. So that painful part isn't there all by itself. And so that helps that painful part to transform and to relax. Just like with friends and with children, you know, they go through their problem and they're being held and they work it out and they're fine. So we can give that type of space internally so that the mind enjoys a lot more shanti because it has somebody inside who can help. So that was somebody taught that many, many years ago. I remember still to this day when he talked in the 70s, he was talking about this. He didn't elaborate on it, but he was talking about it even then. how to come as an inner friend, you know, to your body and mind and sense organs and your moods and your emotions, how to be there. Because by doing that, not only do they all relax and feel cared for and loved, but the bottom line for you is shanti. Okay, so we learn how to just have that inner relationship all the time, actually. But when you're doing in meditation, then you're actually practicing and it just becomes natural because it's a much nicer way to be. To have somebody in an internal support system rather than one that's tearing us down or hurting us more. You know, so the buddhi then creates a whole inner atmosphere. Once I can do that, this is just a little segment, but we're going to, next week we'll extend it quite a bit more. But you can think, see that the way I hold myself internally, all the little ones inside, even my mind, you know, all my emotions, if I hold it myself in that way, it becomes much easier to come into relationship with others that, in that same way, in the real world. And not only that, if I know that there's me, this the adult, with this Buddhian value system that is relating with the world, and that also underneath all that there's this little child and that little child, if I'm aware of that in myself, then I'm aware of that in you also. There's you, the one who, you know, is just the persona, the one who's dealing in the world, and there's also the little ones inside that are influencing me emotionally. You know, just like inside of you, there's little ones that are influencing you emotionally because they're being triggered. In everyone in the world also, there's the persona, there's the adult, and there are the little ones inside that are being influencing you emotionally. And so when we start doing even more work on a relationship, you know, like one exercise we'll do next time or soon enough, is if you go inside and you just go from person to person in your inner circle of people that you have contact with, you'll go, you just think of this one, no, that's fine, no problems, you moved, fine, and then you go to get to this one finally, and it's like, this is a hard one. You're not fine when you think of this person. It isn't fine. And so then there becomes a ways of exercises we can do in sitting internally with that person, because that person's inside of you. They're all inside of you, right? They're outside too, but we're carrying them around inside of us. So it's again relational, causing pressure. So that's what we have to work on. We did this little segment, can work on it, and just remember it, you can understand the principle, and then you do it all in your own way, in a way that is meaningful for you. But I think it's helpful just as a precursor, just this little bit as a precursor to your meditative practice, and then just do what you always do. And then I'll give some other sections. There's three or four different sections. It's helpful. It's helpful for me. Swamiji's doing quite a bit with this now too, especially even the external relationships that we have, you know, to really objectify that whole thing and see all of the karma, the intricate karma that has brought you and this person together in this tense situation. So many layers and layers and layers of karma and interaction that have gone into producing this particular tense situation. And when you start seeing all that's involved that got you both into this, to produce this particular emotion, it's very interesting. You see it all as Ishvara. Now just think about it, two, say an external relationship, two people come together at a given point, and there's an emotional explosion. Okay? So that emotional explosion that has occurred has been produced. It's a product, right? And so if you think of it as Ishvara, this, all of these laws coming together, you know, and there, you can spread it out, this happened, and this happened, this happened, this happened to this person, this, all of these things happened, and then we finally come together at this moment, and what happens is this emotional explosion, which is a product. And then you start seeing it as more as Ishvara. You know, and you can also see it in a much broader picture, and then you can see, you know, what could I change? What can I change to change that dynamic? So, yeah, we'll do some of those. But it helps. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
What if you're doing this inner child work and they won't talk? They won't speak.
You know, if the different parts inside don't talk or speak, it doesn't matter. You can just sit there with them. Say if you're aware of their presence. You know, and be patient. They know you're there. I don't believe that there's anyone who doesn't have little split off parts inside. That's a Jungian way of saying it. But to think that there's not any parts inside, I don't think is real. And so then what you can do is just be with, if there's no talking going on, you can just be with the feelings. And you can say, well, I feel that. I feel you in that way, and I feel you in that way.
Because you know it. You know they're there. You know.
You can feel them, yeah. And if you can feel them, feel those parts. If everybody's, after some time, you know, all those parts can be fine because they all feel held. If all of the parts in the unconscious, I mean the shadow part, if they all feel, because you've spent time with them, and they all feel fine because you're always in relationship with them, then they're happy and everyone's fine. And you can feel that, you'll feel that inside. Everybody's fine. There's nothing. But sometimes you don't feel that. Sometimes there's hurt parts inside, you know. And if they just feel, you can feel that hurt and you can talk to them, and if they don't talk to you, you can say, that's okay, it's all right, I'm here. Yeah, it's just like a pouting, not that that's in your case, but say a short little child that's just pouting and doesn't want to talk or anything, but they like it that you're there. Oh, that's all psychological language, but how Jung will talk about it. All the language that we use is really kind of an imagery, but it works. If you look at how he'll say is the conscious mind is the mind that with all of its energy and everything is available to be in relationship with you in this outside external world. So that's the conscious mind. But when, as you're growing up especially, parts of situations happen which are very hurtful. And they might not be hurtful for an adult, but for a little child, it's too much. And so what will happen is that there will be a shutdown. That little child part will shut down. And that experience, that child had, is encapsulated and put into the unconscious. Sometimes you can even see it happening with a little child. Something will happen, you know. And then they just glass over, completely glass over, for a few minutes or so, and then they get going with their own play and whatnot. You know, and so we say when something traumatic like that happens, you know, for a little child, the experience as though splits off from the conscious mind and it's stored in the unconscious. And what we say is that the conscious mind can now, can actually come into relationship with that split off part. It's as though part of the conscious mind got sequestered into the unconscious, got captured, like some energy holding that experience got captured and held in the unconscious so that the child doesn't have to experience it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's called, the, especially before you're 7 or 8, I'd say 7 years old at least, logic, you start to have logic and reasoning at that time, between 6 and 8. But, and so that allows you to kind of have cause and effect and make sense out of your experience and that type of thing. But until that time, the defense system just does all the work for you. Confusing experience just takes it away, so you don't have to deal with it. When you get a little older, then you can, you have kind of more control over the more understanding of the things that are happening, and so the defense system isn't so all-encompassing and just orders things, takes care of things for you to just protect you, really. You know? But then all of that stuff is stored in the unconscious, and the defense system, it keeps guarding these experiences. You know, even when you're 80 years old, it's still it's guarding the little 2-year-old experience. You know, until you learn how to talk to the defense system and go in and dialogue with these parts, then they will relax and that energy will come back into consciousness, into the conscious mind. The conscious mind actually regains some of its, what we call libido, some of its psychic energy. It regains because a lot of it is stored in the unconscious. And I even think more and more now, some definitely feel this, but more and more psychologists realize that the unconscious material is actually stored in the body. That's why when you're doing some somatic work, different types of, many different types of somatic psychology work and different types of massage that actually will release a lot of feelings and emotion. Which is actually the unconscious, which is being held in the physical body. And then as you do that, you'll feel your body also enjoy a lot more relaxation. So you can do that with, you know, the different somatic methods. But this inner dialogue also releases. It's just going at it from the standpoint of the psyche instead of from the standpoint of the body. And so you feel your own unconscious material integrating, or unconscious parts of you actually coming back into the conscious mind. So Jung will say, like, split off parts. They're like, he looks at it as autonomous entities, but they're not big enough to be the whole conscious mind. They're just little, like, fragments. But those fragments are there as little, you know, they're not fully developed egos, but they're little beings that need to come back home. You have to go back in and get them by coming into relationship with them, and then that energy, you know, gets released and comes back into the.
So ignoring all that, it doesn't. They don't get.
Yeah, they don't. No, they can be there your whole life, and then when they're there in the unconscious, what happens is they get triggered by events, and so that's how they kind of sneak out. By overwhelming your ego, that's a psychology language, by overpowering your mind. You know, like something will happen that will trigger that unconscious part, and that unconscious part will then overwhelm your conscious mind, and then you feel, I'm so unhappy, I'm so hurt. And a lot of times the reactions are so out of proportion to what actually happened, which is a key, you know. That can tell you, oh, there's something else going on here. But what you get used to doing is when you have, you know, emotions and feelings, and you go in directly into relationship with a feeling, you can say, well, what is that? What are you really feeling? What is that really about? You know, we usually don't do that. We usually have the feeling and then are in relationship to the environment or to the situation rather than the buddhi coming into relationship with the feeling. And hold, you know, which is much better, because that means that it's much better in the sense that you have a friend inside who will help, who wants to help, you know. That makes you a much more stable person. Otherwise, we're so dependent on all of these emotions and things coming up, and then it came up because of this and because of that and because of this, and who's going to help me? It's all total samsara without any control. Whereas this way, you know, the buddhi has, there's some inner relationship. You know, was that something you were going to ask?
Yeah.
This kind of gets back to something I think you're saying at some point, where it becomes stronger in relation to the manas.
Yes, that's right. Normally, the manas carries the emotions, and the manas will overwhelm the buddhi. Right? I was talking about that in terms of antikarana shuddhi and getting nishta in the knowledge of the last class. But here, this is not so much, this is applies to the nishta also. But say you have an emotion, normally the emotion just arises in the mind, right? And then the buddhi says, I am sad. The ahankara says, I am sad. Now what we're learning is that the buddhi can actually come into relationship with the emotion and talk to it. And the buddhi can say, you're feeling really sad, tell me what that's about. And that is such an amazing thing to do, because when you speak to the manas, to the emotion, and with interest and say, tell me what it is, what is really bothering you, what's really hurting you about this, then it will tell you. You know, and in that telling, there's a certain clarity that takes place, and that also just its feeling heard dissipates a lot of the emotion. It makes it much better. You know, it's kind of like if you go to therapy and you tell your therapist all of the whatever happened, whatever is bothering you. And then the objectivity and kind of the care and compassion of the therapist helps solve that burden that you're carrying. But we're just doing that internally. Does that make sense? And so the mana starts to rely on the inner friend of the buddhi. You know, the strength of the buddhi. And so that itself, once the buddhi knows how to do that, it really strengthens the buddhi and gives the manas a home, a friend, inner friend, you know, which reduces the angst of the manas, of the emotion. Do you follow me? Yeah. So it's just a lot of words right now, but if you actually work with it, you'll see that the words are actually pointing to something that's very helpful.
I was a little surprised to hear you say to not sit for any prescribed amount of time, because I guess I had always been taught, I think, something about like showing the mind that it's not in control by not letting it when meditation was over, I guess. I was wondering if you could.
Well, you can try that if it works for you, but sometimes, you know, meditation becomes a tapas, you know, instead of a sanctuary. And if you put a lot of rules and restrictions on it, the amount of time, then I guess it's like going to the gym or something, rather than being something that's really holding and containing you. And it's just a way of taking that type of pressure off. Now, say you want to do a certain practice for a certain amount of time to build up some certain skill or strength or something, you can always do that. There's nothing wrong in it. But say that's the only type of meditation you do, then there's not a real... It can take away from there being a real sanctuary for the mind, which is really for it, for its well-being, rather than just a discipline. You can play with it. If you like to do a disciplined practice, you can do that also. But it's nice to have some time which is not that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so you could do both.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But what about when the mind goes, you want to meditate, you want to do your meditation practice, and then the mind comes in and says, oh, I'm sorry, we really don't have time for that right now. Which, and then what it will say is, it'll stop wanting to meditate because there really isn't time, I don't have that much time. You know, so then it'll just stop doing it. But what about, you always have a minute, you always have 5 minutes. You can always say, no, it's about time. It's not about time, I'm just going to do it for a few minutes and then let the mind have at least that. And then you can have your discipline time also. You also get used to, with this, you get used to meditating all the time. Because it's not about time. It's about inner relationship. Like, I don't need to be sitting anywhere to do any of this. Really. That's what you learn. You don't need to be sitting anywhere. Sitting somewhere and just having that peace is a beautiful luxury. You know? But you can also just have this all the time.
You mean...
Because the relationship is natural.
Well, it's like saying, I want the inner friend to come, you know?
But what if when the inner friend is always there?
That's what I was saying, yeah.
Exactly, when the inner friend is always there, and the inner friend's always there because you get used to it. In meditation, you get... At first, it's a novel idea, but once you've evoked that, it becomes absolutely natural. And then as we go on, I mean, I just gave you this little part, but when you think about it, the self is never away from the buddhi, right? Yourself is never away from the buddhi. And it doesn't matter whether you're sitting quietly or you're walking or you're talking, the self is still never away from the buddhi. And so once that relationship is there between the mitya buddhi and the real self, it's there. But we're just, in what's wonderful about meditation is that we just slow everything down to give the mind a chance to recognize all of this and come into these relationships in a way that's very real for it. But then you'll find those relationships are always there. You know, there's never a time when you're not there, when the Atma's not there. There's never a time really when the buddhi is not there. It's just how is the buddhi used to relating to all of the phenomena? You know, the manas and the sense organs and the body and all of these people. And how is the buddhi used to relating to Ishvara? How does the buddhi hold its relationship with the self and the self with it? Right, so we just give some time for it to see all of this. And then, in fact, that's just the way it is. It's not meditating or not meditating. In fact, in Aparokshana Buddhi, this really beautiful text by Shankara, the last, I'd say 20 verses or so, he says something like, why do I have to sit to meditate? So he has a bunch of statements like that.
Well, then,
not saying that we shouldn't sit to meditate.
Yeah. then what do you say to, what does the buddhi say to the mind if for the manas when it gets, say, in a very hurtful place, you know, because, which is overwhelming. In that situation, then what?
Well, if the buddhi can say, if it can be with that hurt and say, I know you're really hurting, you know? And then just say, tell me about it, and you just become a good listener. Mm. Yeah. And then say, it's so overwhelming that even the buddhi is knocked flat for the time being because the tidal wave was too much. Mm. You can talk to somebody else. You can always talk to somebody else. Or you can just say, you know what, this will pass. Which it will. Remind yourself, this will pass. And hand the whole thing over to Bhagavan. So right now we're doing this little section right here is just come have the buddhi come into relationship. But then the buddhi, another thing we have to do is the buddhi has to come into relationship with Ishvara. We've only everything's just on the buddhi right now, poor thing. But then the buddhi also needs to be held. It needs to be held by Ishvara, needs to be held by the self. So we haven't worked on that yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of this class.
Would it be fair to say that when you have dreams and there are lots of characters in the dreams,
yeah,
those characters are kind of the living representation, like a 3D movie of these characters playing out their different relationships.
Yeah, or it can be like a total 3D movie of a certain part of your psyche that's giving you, you know, in this dream. You can go into the dream, to all of the different parts of the dream, and actually go into dialogue with all of those parts too. Like, say there's a main character in the dream, you can actually just bring that dream back to mind and go in and talk to that main character, or any character, or even an animal or a tree. Say a tree is the main, one of the main, so the tree is important in the dream. You can go into dialogue with that tree to find out more. Or say the dream ended abruptly and you think, oh no. Yeah, then you can go back and push the dream forward. Just go to walk one of the characters and say, what were you going to do? I woke up right when you were doing that. What were you going to do? And then let the dream move forward. That's, again, it's all coming into relationship and taking your dream seriously, which is the dream world. The unconscious likes to be taken seriously, like you're communicating with it, and you can do that through your dreams also. Both Jung and Freud, and of course modern day psychologists, but they called the dream the royal road to the unconscious. It's the language of the unconscious. And so it's really nice to pay attention to them. Jung once even said, if you don't pay attention to your dreams, it's like receiving a letter from a loved one or something and never opening them. Yeah, you got this letter? No. And then pretty soon they just don't write you anymore. Here's that example. They just won't pay. They won't keep trying to communicate with you. But if you receive them and come into some sort of relationship with them, then the dreams will keep giving to you, you know, because you're in relationship. So many ways it's all about relationship, you know. Stop.